With our special guest, Linda Moulton Howe, up next, we talk about strange animal mutilations happening in the United States and in British Columbia. What is going on? Linda with the story next on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, this story that seems to be permeating out throughout the United States and in British Columbia is one of the strangest I've seen in a long time. But you've covered a lot of mutilation stories.
Oh, hundreds. Literally hundreds and hundreds. Because I began this as director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver in September of 79. That was when I made my first phone calls to ranchers and sheriffs and deputies and talked with other reporters. And it was in September, October, November, December of 79 that I was hearing sheriff after sheriff, deputy after deputy saying to me, only off the record, Linda, we're dealing with creatures from outer space. And I said, well, I'm trying to do a television documentary. I need you to say that in front of a camera. Oh, no, no, you'll have to get somebody else. And finally, it was Lou Giroto, who was the head of the animal mutilation investigation in the Trinidad District Attorney's Office in Trinidad, Colorado. And when the crew and I were running a camera at 10 o'clock at night, the only time he would give us, and I asked him the question I was asking everybody, who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals and why? Lou Giroto looked straight at me and said, other investigators and I have come to the conclusion that we're dealing with creatures from outer space. And that scene is in my documentary, A Strange Harvest. Well, right now in 2010, there has been another upsurge of large animal mutilations in both hemispheres, as well as the half-cat phenomena that I have reported on Coast and at Earth Files for quite a long time. And what you can do, if for those of you who would like to see what I'm talking about, you can go to earthfiles.com and click. I put this in an environment report, but there is warning that some of the photos are quite graphic. They're not bloody. Would you agree, George? You're not looking at anything.
No, there's hardly no blood at all.
And that's what has always made the phenomena so eerie. So for those who would like to see what we're talking about, go to earthfiles.com and click for the text and the images. And to know that just since June of 2010, we're talking about June, July, August, September, just 4.5 months, there have been three front halves of cats found in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, half a dozen half cats discovered in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, three cat heads alone found in Portland, Oregon. This is all without blood. A cat in San Antonio, Texas, found dead with all of its internal organs surgically removed. This is a variation that some of the cats, the whole body will be there and none of the organs inside. Five mutilated cats in Ocean Beach near San Diego. These are half cats. Seven half cats in Garden City, Hertfordshire, England, north of London. Nine half cats in Sacramento, California's Rosemont neighborhood. Two half cats in Federal Way, Washington State. Half of a cat found in the Glenfield district of Western Sydney, Australia. And nine half cats in the Vancouver, BC, Canada region. So we have talked about Canada, the United States, England, and Australia since June. All just now we're talking about cats, most of them cut in half. Those nine half cats found in White Rock, Langley, and West Vancouver regions have been reported since July of 2010 to the Surrey office for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And the most recent half-cat there was reported on September 25th in White Rock, similar to the front half-cat that was found in March of 1993, also in Vancouver, Canada. I show a photograph at Earth Files in my report because I worked with the then supervisor of animal control for the Vancouver City Pound, Vic Warren, and Dr. John Altshuler, and a hematologist and pathologist in Denver. And when I talked with Mr. Warren, he said, Linda, quote, these cats are clearly being butchered by someone. It's a really surgical job. All I hope is that these cats were already dead when they were cut in half.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, well, there's no blood. And Dr. Altshuler was able in his lab in Denver to confirm that the excision through the entire half of the front half of the cat had been made with high heat, cauterizing and preventing blood flow, but he could not find any carbon residue in the tissue, which is the same problem we have had in large animals.
Strange.
I interviewed one of the investigators of the most recent 2010 half-cat cases in Vancouver, and he is Sergeant Peter Thiessen, Senior Media Relations for the Lower Mainland District of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Surrey, British Columbia, Canada, and here now is Sergeant Thiessen.
Okay. It appeared that they were cleanly cut in half surgically, and it didn't appear that any of these animals came in contact with a predator. And we had one animal looked at by a vet, and it was determined that that particular cat was cut post-mortem.
And was he able to determine anything about the nature of the excision or the cutting instrument?
Not that I'm aware of, but it was a very clean surgical cut.
In other cases, including one in Vancouver in the mid-1990s that I worked on with a hematologist pathologist, he was able to confirm that the entire cat had been cut in half with something that cooked the hemoglobin and the collagen throughout the entire excision. In that case, it was the front half with the head end of the cat that was found in a Vancouver community.
Interesting.
Between September 25th and October 12th, so far, have you heard about any other reports in your jurisdiction or outside of your jurisdiction?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was the White Rock September 25th half-cat the only case in September?
No, we had the first reported one was reported on September 20th. But then that was in the local media. And then on September 25th, two other people came forward after they heard about the September 20th report and advised that their cats were found in similar conditions some weeks prior, but they didn't report it at the time.
Where there have been half cats reported in the United States, local police units will send patrol cars around during the night into neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Does the RCMP send out any field investigation units to these areas like White Rock or any of the others where half-cats have been found?
Well, the police of jurisdiction in White Rock would be aware of the incidents, and when they have the opportunity, they would make patrols as a routine. This information would be passed on to the patrol officers to be aware of it and to watch for anything suspicious. So I guess my answer to that would be yes.
But the RCMP, as an agency, isn't putting out investigators at night in these areas?
Not specifically for this investigation, no.
While Sergeant Thiessen and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have been trying to solve the half-cat mystery in Vancouver, Canada, nearly 2,000 miles away in Flowery Branch, Georgia, southwest of Gainesville, longtime cattle farmers John and Kathy Cooper have been plagued by unusual cow deaths. They have a 200-acre farm, and since the late summer of 2009, 20 cows and bulls have been found dead. Some of the cows have had their udders removed without blood, while bulls have had their penis neatly excised. And in a couple of cases, testicles were cut out as well. In the month of May alone this year, the Coopers found 7 of their cattle dead. The University of Georgia has had 2 bodies for necropsies and tissue and fluid analyses. But to date, none of the veterinarians nor the frustrated Hall County Sheriff's Department have come up with firm answers about who or what has killed the 20 cows in 12 months. Here now is farm owner Kathy Cooper to describe what has happened.
The very first one that we found that we knew we were being mutilated, we called the police, and that was probably our fourth kill.
Mm-hmm.
We had already buried the other ones because you're just looking at them and you're thinking, what in the world is going on? And then we thought it was a cow. And once I got up there, it was like a 500-pounder, and that would have been the first small one that they had killed. I saw the testicles. And I told my husband, this was a bull. They have taken off its penis.
Mm-hmm.
But you know for sure it was cut. There was activity of some sort there that wasn't animal related. you know, his testicle area was still intact, but they had taken the penis part.
Right.
So that's when we started really trying to find out what was wrong, and I called the police and I called the Gainesville Times and told them that we wanted a little bit of a story out there so that somebody might call me and tell me what had happened.
Right, and was there any blood?
No. And, you know, the eyes are still clear. It's just obvious it hasn't been dead that long. But you don't know how they've been killed. You don't see any signs of evidence of any kind of violence against them. There's no bullet wounds, no knives. They're just dead, but their private part is missing. And so then, after that, we had a lull time, and we find another bull calf. And this bull is laying there on its back pretty much, and its legs are almost like, its hip joints are almost like disconnected. It was so wide open, and they had cut his penis off and his testicles, but they had taken the testicles out of the bag itself and left the bag there. The testicles are missing. And then we found a cow a couple of months later. This would have been in January, probably. And she had been dead a little while, but it was obvious that her milk bag had been cut off. And how we sort of get clued into them is that we might smell them, but we don't see vultures. There's no vulture activity. We're used to seeing an animal go down, and before they've been dead very long, the buzzards have pecked their eyes out, and then they go to the anus area and peck that out. And then they might wait for a few days for more decay and then try to get more into it.
And so this indicates that there is some residue that is even keeping vultures away
right.
from these bodies.
That is a clue. Then early into May, we had our first one that we took for the necropsy. We found 7 in 1 week. There were 3 that were in our creek. They were all lined up. Only one had mutilation, and she had her shoulder pretty much like dislocated, and the skin had been pulled below her elbow. They cut this watermelon-sized circle right around her chest area.
Was her heart removed?
I couldn't tell. I have a picture of it, but I looked thinking that's what they would be looking to get. That's the only time that's ever happened.
And what happened on that case?
They come and take pictures. They make a report, which I call them every time I know it 100% sure it's a mutilation. You know, there's no doubt in our mind that the milk bag's been cut off or the penis has been cut off. They have record of that because it's just obvious, and that's what they say for sure. There's no doubt in their mind that it happened that way. But UGA has this last one that got killed 2 weeks ago today. I took her down there. She was fairly fresh. She's walking. You can see where somebody's like trying to herd her into the woods out of sight. She collapses forward. Her back legs sort of fall underneath her, so her butt's sort of up in the air. And so they're able to get in there to get the milk bag off, which they did. But there was like an imprint of knees and elbows in there. It had rained on Sunday. So I take pictures of that on my phone, and I send it to the vet at UGA, and I tell him we're on our way. We're bringing her. And when we get there, I tell him, she had a little trickle of blood coming out of her eye. Her eyes are still clear, but in her tear duct, there was a little bit of blood, but her head is going downhill just a little bit. And this is the only time this has happened, but 3 or 4 little specks of blood on her inside shoulder where it looked like needle pricks or something. I asked him to check that out. I said, I really know we have to be checking organs. We need to be checking poison. We need to know how she died. The milk bag cutting off thing didn't kill her. Just like the other one that went down there for autopsy, they were in movement. And she collapses, and then her milk bag is taken. So we're trying to find out what actually put her down. But I don't have the complete autopsy back on her yet.
What did they say when you got there?
Well, they said it was obvious that it was cut off. We felt like she was fairly fresh because her eye was still very clear. So I didn't think she'd been dead 24 hours.
Right.
My husband's raised cows all his life. He and I have been married 25 years, so I've been involved in that for that long. And you can usually tell. I mean, there was no swelling. There's no odor. I said, test her stomach. Find out what's in her stomach. See if somebody's fed her something that has put her down.
Right.
This cow was 8 weeks pregnant. She had blood in her stomach, and she had blood clotting in her intestines. But that's all I know so far about her.
And when the pathologist from the University of Georgia called you to tell you that the intestines had blood clots and the stomach was full of blood,
mm-hmm.
Did she say anything about cause of death or any other details?
They don't know anything yet, as far as I know.
So, Kathy, after a year and at least 20 animals dead, of which perhaps 10 would fall into the category of classic animal mutilations.
Right.
You still don't have a single definitive answer from any necropsy or authority.
No, we don't have any answers there. And our mutilations, it's strictly a milk bag or a penis testicle situation. It's not eyes, ears, nose, throat, nothing else. Strictly the milk bag. And if it's a boy, they go for the penis. Sometimes they take the testicles, sometimes not.
And, you know, George, it's really interesting about this particular one. If you look at the photos at earthfiles.com, where the cow is down on all four knees. So you have to look under the cow to even see that the udder has been removed. And the, based on all of the cases that I have been involved with, it reminded me of ones where we have found broken bones in animals and various other tests that have been done on soil that have indicated that animals have been dropped from a height onto the ground. And so I have sent, in fact, one of these reports to Kathy and John Cooper so they can see what other work has been done by scientists and people analyzing where a cow has been found in an unusual way. In this case, when you look at these photos, if you go to the right now, George, you will see that this animal is lying almost like it was all kneeled down. It's very unusual for a cow, and that they, the only way they could photograph the udder is you have to get up and you're taking a photograph underneath the cow. So it's not clear that these two marks right behind the cow in freshly rained on soil, it's not really clear what they are. They originally were thinking that somebody maybe was standing there, but I am suggesting that there is another possibility that the udder had been removed somewhere else and the cow had been dropped into this position. And today I learned about yet another amazing horse mutilation in Sussex, England, near Eastbourne, which is down in the far south from London on the English Channel.
And very similar?
Well, this is a horse. It's a gelding. And it has some of the classic removals of tissue. That would include a rectangle from the jaw. It would be it was a gelding, so the testicles weren't there. It was only 2 years old, but the testicles are taken early in a gelding. But the very unusual excisions of tissue from the penis, I have seen these photos, and I'm going to have an Earth Files report up, I hope, by Sunday or Monday from this new case in England. And I would like to let you and the Coast listeners know that the investigators are Richard D. Hall and David Caton with the Animal Pathology Field Unit in England. And Richard Hall also does videos, and he has a website where he is going to post a documentary that is going to be broadcast in December on UK television about animal mutilations and unusual phenomena. And his website is richplanet.net. Richplanet.net on December 4th. All Coast listeners could go to richplanet.net and see his documentary that will have video of what I'm going to do at Earth Files with photos and an interview with Richard Hall coming soon.
Up next, Linda's final segment investigating the missing bees, and then next hour, Conversations with Linda. Well, next hour we'll take phone calls, your calls, Conversations with Linda. When we come back, she did a little more research into the colony collapse disorder. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, when did you realize there was something wrong with the bee situation? How did that happen for you?
Well, let's see. It was nearly 4 years ago on February 23rd, 2007. And it was that date that I produced my first Earth Files report. And it was about what scientists were saying was, it was a quote, alarming disappearance of honeybees. And it was between the fall of 2006 and the spring of 2007 that 22 states in the United States had beekeepers who reported that they had lost 60%, up to 100% of the honeybees in their colonies. And most of the bees never, ever returned to any of the hives. And Pennsylvania beekeeper Dave Hackenberg lost 60% of his colonies that fall. And he told me in that first interview that he and other beekeepers thought the culprits were nicotine-based insecticides getting into crops that flower, and then those insecticides being systemic come up into the pollen and kill their bees. That's what he told me all the way back then. Well, that was the first time that I heard about this nicotine-based pesticide called imidacloprid, which when you hear the word gaucho, gaucho is another registered name that is imidacloprid as well. They are nicotine-based insecticides, and they are made by Bayer Crop Science in Germany.
That's the same company that also makes pharmaceuticals, right?
Yes. It's one of the biggest companies in the world.
Yep.
And their nicotine-based insecticides are sold to be applied to seeds. So that means that as the seeds begin to grow, that the insecticide goes flowing into the plant stems, leaves, flowers, pollens, and nectars if they have flowers, like, say, canola, which is known as oilseed rape in England, and canola here. Now, so in other words, right from the fall of 2006, the beginning of colony collapse disorder as a syndrome was at the same time when the beekeepers themselves were saying it's nicotine-based insecticides. Well, I've been reporting, I've done, I don't know, 10, 15, 18 reports now, since that first February 23rd, 2007, on evolving information on colony collapse disorder, what is happening to honeybees, and a decline in pollinators basically around most of the northern hemisphere. And you lead up to October 6th, 2010, only a couple of weeks ago or so, and the New York Times headlines, quote, "Scientists and soldiers solve a bee mystery," close quote. Well, I saw that headline on about the day that it came out in the New York Times, and I was really puzzled. The news was a research article, and it's postulating, means it's not proved, it's postulating that a DNA-based, what's called a ritavirus, combined with a Nosema fungi, were the answer to what was killing the honeybees in the colony collapse disease research. Well, the main scientist behind this new science paper is Jerry Bromenschenk, PhD. He owns Bee Alert Technology, Inc. in Missoula, Montana. He collaborated with the United States Army Edgewood Chemical Biological Center, the Aberdeen Proving Ground, and other agencies and institutions. But the word solved in the New York Times headline puzzled not only me, but other bee scientists who knew that viruses in fungi had already been found in large quantities in the guts of dead honeybees back in 2007 lab investigations, right after all the beekeepers began saying they were losing the bees. They found fungi and virus, and that's when the bee researchers concluded that the viruses in the fungi were opportunists taking advantage of damaged honeybee immune systems. The unanswered questions were and still are, what is suppressing honeybee immune systems so much, and why do so many honeybees apparently die in the fields and never return to their hives? Well, 2 days after the New York Times article, Fortune.com followed up on October 8th, 2010 with another headline, quote, "What a scientist didn't tell the New York Times about his study on bee deaths," close quote. The allegation by reporter-writer Catherine Eben was that Dr. Jerry Bromenschenk of Bee Alert was funded by Bayer in Germany to look at disease. Eben quoted others who implied Bayer's intent is to keep deliberately scientists from studying its largest selling insecticide on Earth, and that is imidacloprid. Imidacloprid is defined by Bayer as a, quote, nicotine acetylcholine receptor agonist antagonist, close quote. That's right out of their website. Well, lab tests have confirmed this nicotine-based insecticide will interfere with the nerve impulse transmissions in insects, including honeybees. The affected insects die when their body functions won't work. And the question is, how much imidacloprid, or gaucho in another name, is necessary to get up into the flowers and the pollen to end up basically making it impossible for the bees to function and then dying? Well, in 1999, France banned imidacloprid and gaucho from use on sunflowers and corn, two of the Bayer Crop Science produced insecticides. And then Italy followed with bans as well. And yet, in the last 2 years, in spite of beekeepers there saying that these nicotine-based insecticides were killing their bees, bans have been sort of rescinded or modified under what? Commercial pressures. Imidacloprid is the largest selling insecticide for Bayer. Well, farmer concerns were not confined to France and Italy. Very disturbing in 2003 were reports from North Dakota beekeepers that 60% of their honeybee colonies died after gaucho imidacloprid had been applied to their canola crops, similar to what happened in France and Italy. One scientist who followed up to help the North Dakota canola farmers was Daniel F. Mayer, PhD. Dr. Mayer spent 35 years working as a research and extension entomologist for Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. And he is a co-author of a 2000 book entitled Crop Pollination by Bees. After traveling several times to 17 different bee yards in North Dakota, and seeing dead bees and bees that trembled and moved erratically in what looked like imidacloprid poisoning, Dr. Mayer took samples from the canola plants and the damaged honeybee colonies. And Dr. Mayer found gaucho imidacloprid in flowers, pollens, wax, bees, and the honey supers used to collect honey in commercial beehives, all at surprising levels in the second year after the first application of the nicotine-based insecticide. That's when Dr. Mayer joined 13 North Dakota beekeepers led by Carrington, North Dakota beekeeper Chris Charles in a class action lawsuit against Bayer Crop Science in Germany. But strangely, the federal court judge in Washington, D.C., who watched over 3 years of depositions, testimonies, and all, suddenly decided that Dr. Mayer was not a qualified expert, and the case was summarily dismissed. Many wondered who Bayer paid off that time. Here now is Dr. Daniel Mayer.
Beekeepers there saw dead bees. So I went out there in 2003, examined the colonies. I went out there three times, and we sent some samples in to a lab in Florida, and they found imidacloprid in the honey and the bees and the wax. I mean, that pretty much nails it down.
Because imidacloprid is one of the nicotine-based pesticides that Bayer makes.
Right. And gaucho was being sold as a seed treatment for canola. In that part of North Dakota, lots of acreages of canola were being treated. So the bees were pretty much confined to foraging on imidacloprid-treated canola.
Mm-hmm.
What our test showed was that the bees would forage on this crop, and then the imidacloprid would build up in the super. There's honey and pollen still in there.
Right.
Then the second year, when you took that super and put it back on a honeybee colony, there'd be enough imidacloprid in there to affect the colony and cause colony decline. And the colony would not make any honey and it would die. They were losing up to 60% of the colonies, the beekeepers there in North Dakota.
And that was 2003.
Right.
If I understand correctly, what you were finding is that there was a year-to-year buildup of the nicotine-based pesticide so that it might not have hurt the bees one application in the first year, but that it does tend to build up and this is what might have been undoing the bees and causing all the disappearances.
Yes, it was causing it, in my mind, my opinion.
What is that risk to the bees and pollinators? What happens in the presence of nicotine-based pesticides?
Well, if they get enough, a certain level, it's going to cause harm to the individual bee and to the colony. And if there's enough imidacloprid that gets into the colony, it's going to kill the colony.
And it causes disorientation, right, in the bee brain?
Yes.
Can you describe what you've seen with your own eyes?
The bee is being affected by a pesticide. It kind of trembles. It flips around. It's acting very abnormally. And it's just like kind of like a drunk, twitching, moving around erratically, sometimes unable to fly, crawl. Typical symptoms of bee poisoning.
So if bees are out foraging on canola or another flowering crop, the bee is going to intake that nicotine-based pesticide, and it is going to cause them disorientation to the point that they probably can't return to the hive?
Yeah, there'll be some of that. Just die out in the field.
So what happened next?
Eventually, you know, depositions and all that. And it went to court in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, went in front of a judge. Bear said I was not a qualified expert, and so the judge threw the whole thing out, saying I was not a qualified expert when it comes to pesticides on bees.
But you're an entomologist by PhD, and you had been working in extension and going out and studying what was happening to the honeybees in North Dakota.
And for 35 years, I worked on the pesticides on bees. But the judge, federal judge, threw it out. I know in 2009, when it came up for EPA review, they still had not done any tests to see, you know, if there was imidacloprid in the flowers after the seed treatment. You know, what's really puzzling to me is on the label for gaucho, it clearly stated when it first came out, this material is good for suppression of Liguus bugs and cabbage seed pod weevil during bloom. Now, that proves to me that Bear knew the insecticide was in the bloom and honeybees forage on the bloom. Well, later on, there was some communication in Bear. Oh, we don't know where this statement came from. It's not true. Well, then why did they put it on a label?
I am getting the distinct impression the Bear is trying to buy its innocence in colony collapse disorder by funding research that will look at every other possible culprit except nicotine-based pesticides.
That's probably a pretty good guess. Bear is huge. I mean, it's all over the world. Pesticides, pharmaceuticals, everything. Bear's got a lot of money, and imidacloprid has made a lot of money for them, and so it's in their best interest to do just about anything to keep it on the market. As long as they're using the nicotines, there's going to be problems with pollinators when it's applied to a crop or bees are going to forage. But if you take imidacloprid and spray it on pine trees, there's going to be no effect on pollinators because there's no bloom. But as long as it's used around blooms, especially as a soil treatment or as a seed treatment like gaucho, there's going to be problems with killing bees.
Back to the New York Times surprising headline about Dr. Jerry Bremenchenk of Bee Alert Technology and the U.S. Army, quote, solving, close quote, colony collapse disorder as a 1-2 punch by arytovirus and Nosema fungi. I also ask longtime apiary researcher Jerry Hayes for comment. Mr. Hayes is assistant chief of the Bureau of Plant and Apiary Inspection in the Apiary Inspection Section of the Florida Department of Agriculture in Gainesville, Florida. Here now is Jerry Hayes.
Certainly, Jerry's research is interesting. Is it the holy grail of anything? No, it certainly isn't. If you read his paper, he's not saying it's a cause of CCD, but it could be a possible marker for colony health issues.
Well, don't you think it is peculiar that the New York Times would have a headline, quote, scientists and soldiers solve a bee mystery, close quote?
That's the media for you, Linda.
But what I mean is, it is as if Dr. Bremenchenk and the New York Times reporter Johnson had agreed to do a story about Bremenchenk and the Army solving colony collapse disorder, when in fact, that is highly misleading and the headline is wrong.
I would agree with you.
Nothing has been solved in colony collapse disorder.
No.
Right.
Yeah. The only thing he was pointing out was that he found more of this arenovirus than perhaps other people. It has been found, I think, in 2009, but he was just putting a correlation together between that and Nosema. Viruses and Nosema are markers for colony health problems.
But how do we trust any contradictory reports anymore when Bayer is paying science to come up with other alternatives to explain colony collapse disorder? Even Dr. Bromenschenk himself says that the big problem is no one can trust what Bayer is saying anymore.
Yeah, I certainly have my concerns about not only big government, but big private industry and chemical companies. We should all be more knowledgeable about what we do, how we do it, and who's doing it to us.
What is your bottom line right now about the future of the honeybee industry?
I think it's teetering. It's possibly frightening. But, you know, we've talked about this in the past, Linda. Are honeybees the canary?
Are honeybees the canary in the coal mine?
It's amazing, Linda. Just an amazing story.
Yeah, and it now presents all of us with a challenge. How do we put pressure on what? Congressional representatives, the White House, corporations? How do we try to get things balanced back to something that is honest and has people and Earth life's interests, best interests at heart instead of the almighty buck?
Now, what's the trend right now with the beehive colonies? Is it do you see them revitalizing, or
no.
Is it still going the other way?
Oh, no. Last report that I did on Coast about this is sort of the status, which is in 2000 and the fall of 2009 to through the winter, which is about a year ago, of 2010, the average percentage loss in the United States was about 33% to 34%. And to sustain this, the beekeepers have to keep dividing their colonies, which are not healthy to begin with, right? So they can keep dividing bees to try to get more bees, but none of the bees are healthy. I'm not saying a universal. I'm saying that in the commercial beekeepers that have to go to California and up to the blueberries in the Northeast, the ones that are commercial beekeepers and trucking bees, they are really, really up against the wall about how to keep a business going when the bee health is so low. And if you look at this and say, if the nicotine insecticides, nicotine-based insecticides, are a big part of this problem, as beekeepers have long suspected, and it is an issue of large corporate money, how are we ever going to handle this?
Up next, Conversations with Linda Moulton Howe.